We're going to be looking at the first 11 verses of Luke chapter 6. Michael, our teaching pastor, is away on vacation this week with his wife Christy, and so you can be praying for them that this is a time of refreshment for them. I understand Michael is trying to play a lot of golf, so I don't know whether that's going to be refreshing or discouraging, but you can be praying that it's refreshing for their souls as they're away. Luke chapter 6, if you're new with us this morning, we've been making our way through the book of Luke, and we're in a section of Luke where there's a number of controversies that Jesus faces with the religious leaders of the day. In chapter 5, Jesus makes the great statement that he has the authority to forgive sins, and that doesn't make any of the religious leaders happy. And then he heals a paralyzed man. They're not happy about that. He sat down and he ate with the lowest of society, the tax collectors, the people that they considered both traitors to their nation's cause, but also to be sinners that no one should sit down and eat with. And he hung out with those guys, and then he had a bunch of followers who had much too much fun at parties, and so people were really mad at him about that. And so he's got these religious leaders who are really upset with him, and that's the setting as we go into Luke chapter 6. And Jesus' teaching and Jesus' practices didn't fit into the religious box of these religious leaders. And largely, as you go through the Gospels, you find that Jesus loved what they despised, and for the most part, he despised what they loved. And as we press in this morning to the teaching of Jesus on the Sabbath, you see exactly that Jesus' view of what a Sabbath day, a day of rest, a day of worship, what it looks like in Jesus' context was very different than what the religious leaders had. So let's dive into the text. Luke chapter 6, I'm going to read down through the first 11 verses. Luke writes and says, "On a Sabbath, while he," that's Jesus, "was going through the grain fields, his disciples plucked and ate some grains of grain, rubbing them in their hands. But some of the Pharisees said, 'Why are you doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath?' And Jesus answered them, 'Have you not read what Jesus did? Have you not read what David did when he was hungry? He and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God and took and ate the bread of the presence, which is not lawful for any but the priest to eat, and also gave it to those who were with him. And he said to them, "The Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath." And on another Sabbath, he entered the synagogue and was teaching, and a man was there whose right hand was withered. And the scribes and the Pharisees watched him to see whether he would heal on the Sabbath, so that they might find a reason to accuse him. But he knew their thoughts. And he said to the man with the withered hand, "Come and stand here." And he rose and stood there. And Jesus said to them, "I ask you, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to destroy it?" And after looking around at all of them, he said to him, "Stretch out your hand." And he did so, and his hand was restored. But they were filled with fury and discussed with one another what they might do to Jesus. The settings of these two stories happen on different Sabbaths, but both of them happen on a Sabbath day. The first story, we don't know how far apart these two Sabbath days were, but Luke links them, and I'll show you why I believe that he links these two stories together in a minute. But Luke links these two stories together about what Jesus did on the Sabbath. And the Sabbath is not really a word we use anymore, but it was a word that was integral to their understanding of worship. It's interesting when you start to think about the divisions of time that were very common to us, the division of a year, of a month, and of a day. All of those have their basis in something in the physical universe. The year is the amount of time that it takes for the earth to rotate all the way around the sun one time. You look at a month, and a month is about the amount of time that it takes the moon to go through the lunar phases. You look at a day, and it's about a day is approximately the amount of time that it takes for the earth to rotate one time on its axis. And you look at this artificial, at the surface, division of what is a week. Why do we celebrate a week? Why do we have 7 days in a week and then start over with day number one and do it again? And it has no root in the physical universe anywhere apart from God. God designed the week, and he didn't link it to anything else in the physical universe. And I think he did that on purpose so that there was no way when we get to thinking about the Sabbath and a day of rest and a day of worship that in anywhere in our minds and even in the secular culture, they couldn't take from us the idea of a week and apply it to something in the physical universe. And God did this uniquely for us. And as we press into this a little bit this morning, I think maybe you're going to start to have questions about, well, what does that mean about the way we live and about the way we act? And I just want to say this for you. God gave us a day of rest. And this is a gift for us, and we should understand it and think about it this way. He did it for a twofold reason, as we see in the Old Testament. The first reason that he gives us this day of rest, this idea of the Sabbath, which the word Sabbath literally means to cease and to rest. That's what it means. To cease from your normal work, cease from your rest. And the first purpose that he did it was to give us rest from normal work. He set up the Sabbath in the week. He gave us a day to rest from normal work. And that is rooted in Genesis chapter 2. Genesis chapter 1, you know, God creates the heavens and the earth. We know through Colossians that this was spoken actually through Jesus, which is an interesting connection I'll make later on. But God speaks the universe into existence. And he does that for 6 days. And you get to Genesis chapter 2, and the first part of Genesis chapter 2 says that God finished all of his work. And on the seventh day, God rested. And we understand that to mean, obviously, that God didn't stop doing any activity. If he had stopped completely, the whole universe would have fallen apart. The scriptures say that God holds everything together and that without him, it would all just implode. And so when God rests on the seventh day, it doesn't mean he ceases from all activity, but he ceased from his creative activity in creating the universe. And then when he gives the Ten Commandments, and he starts to give them a commandment that they should labor for 6 days and then they should rest on the seventh day, he brings that thinking back to the creation story. That our God, who our Creator, who has a outstretched arm and a mighty hand, he never wearies. He never gets tired. He never gets exhausted. It's not like at the end of the 6 days, he was like, I just can't handle anything else. I got to go lay down. He didn't even break a sweat when he pulled everything into existence, when he called everything into existence through a spoken word. It didn't even break a sweat doing that. And yet he rested as a model for us of what it should look like. And so he called them to say, I want you to take a rest from your normal work on every 7 day basis. As you wrestle through this and what does this mean in our day and in our culture and how should we practice this, and Jesus gives some interesting advice to us in Mark chapter 2 and verse 27 when Jesus says that God made the Sabbath for man and not the man for Sabbath. And so as we start to think about it, what probably comes to mind is some questions about, well, can I do this and can I do this and can I do this and what about that and what about... And let me just say, as you start to wrestle with that and start to ask those questions, which I think are good questions we should be asking, but what we must do is view it through the lens of what it is, and that is it is a gift from our gracious God who made us and created us and said every 7 days, I want you to pause and I want you to rest from your normal work. I made this for you. It is a precious gift from God for us, our Creator, designed for his creations, a day of rest. The second design that God had in the Sabbath day was that they would remember how God has worked for them. That they would remember how God has worked for them, or you could say how God has worked for us. In Deuteronomy chapter 5, in verses 12 through 15, God is speaking over them the truth of what he has done for them. And he says to them that on the Sabbath day, you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, and therefore the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. He linked it not only to a day of rest, but he also linked it to a day of remembrance of how God has worked on our behalf, had worked on their behalf through Egypt. Think about the state that they were in. They were slaves in Egypt. They had the most powerful ruler in the world. They had no ability to resist him. He forced them to make bricks without straws, as the scripture says. And they could do absolutely nothing about it. They were slaves. They were in bondage. They had no hope. And while they could not work to change their situation, God worked. And what God is saying in the Sabbath day is, on the Sabbath day, I want you to remember that you were powerless to change your situation, and in the midst of your inability to act and to do and to accomplish anything, to get out of your situation, I moved on your behalf. God sent Moses. then God sent the plagues, and then God parted the Red Sea, and then God unparted the Red Sea and had it crash on top of Pharaoh's army and wiped them out, and the Israelites are free on the other side. And God said, on this, every 7 days, I want you to stop, and I want you to remember that you could not do it, and I did it for you. I work. And while you are resting, I am at work. Now, this is a glorious truth that should encourage our hearts and should encourage our souls, that we can't, but God can. This is the story of the gospel. And this is God's dual design in the Sabbath, that we would rest and that we would remember every 7 days. It's interesting that he designed it not and calls us not to a monthly getaway. It's not like every 12 months I want you to, or every month I want you to get away and maybe take some time off. It's not a summer vacation that you go away for 2 weeks and hang out with your family. He designed there to be a rhythm to this that happens every 6 days, that every 6 day we stop from our normal work and remember what God has done for us. It's to be a part of who we are, and God designed it that way, both for our benefit physically, but also for our benefit spiritually, to remember what he had done. And it's on one of these days in Luke chapter 6 that this story unfolds. It's on a Sabbath, and he's going through the grain fields, and his disciples pluck some, in verse 1, and pluck some of these grain, these heads of grain, and they're rubbing them together, and they're eating it. Now, it's important to note about this story that the Old Testament law did not allow the farmers to completely harvest all of their fields. They were to leave the grain that was around the exterior of their fields unharvested so that the poor could come and get something to eat, and so that passersby could stop and have a snack basically along the journey. And so here's Jesus, and they're walking through the grain fields, and the Pharisees see them. Now, seriously, the Pharisees are like following Jesus around through the grain fields on a Sabbath day. I mean, you get the picture of what's going on? And they're not there for the teaching. I mean, they're not there to support Jesus. Jesus is walking through a grain field in the middle of Israel with the disciples and some of his followers, and they're picking up snacks, and the Pharisees got a problem. I mean, seriously, is that really what's happening? Yes, that's what's happening in the story. And they're taking this grain, and they're rubbing it together, and they're putting it in their mouth, and they say, here's their assessment of what's going on. Some of the Pharisees say, why are you doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath? I love that the only thing they can find about Jesus is stuff like his followers are eating a snack in the middle of a grain field. It speaks a lot to the perfection of Jesus. I think Luke is writing to a skeptic, and this is another example of this. This is the best they can do. Then this lawful here is not, it's not God's law that they're talking about. They're talking about their traditions. Their Jewish traditions, we know, historians tell us that they had hundreds of thousands of these rules and traditions that they had to keep, and particularly on the Sabbath. The Talmud, which is this keeping or large book of Jewish traditions, had 24 chapters on Sabbath rules that they had to keep. Here's an example of what we're talking about. We're talking about it was considered work to take an object in one hand, throw it up, and catch it with the other. If you caught it with the same hand, that was cool, but if you used both hands in that activity, well, that was work and that was out of bounds. No one was allowed to carry an object that weighed more than a dry fig. You couldn't eat anything larger than an olive, or you'd do too much work chewing, I guess. You could only carry enough ink to write 2 letters of the alphabet. It was a violation for a woman to pluck a gray hair from her head. I'll leave that one alone. Medical care could only be given to sustain life, but not to restore health. And it was considered work to pull off a handful of grain and then rub it in your hand and then eat it. This is what the Pharisees accused Jesus of. You're doing what's not lawful. It wasn't that it wasn't lawful. It was a breaking their traditions. And they have a major problem with it. And Jesus, as I love what he does, he's going to ask them a question in response to their question. And the issue is that these guys are walking around through grain fields trying to figure out whether his followers are going to pluck off a little head of grain. And there's no rest in this, and there's no remembering in this. And that's the issue. At the heart of this is a heart issue with the Pharisees. That on the Sabbath day, what they're looking to do is to uphold their rules and traditions. And there's no rest from work. As a matter of fact, they've just piled on the work. They've piled on the effort. They've piled on the things that have to be done. And there's no remembering about how God has worked, and therefore their work is no longer necessary. It's all mangled up. And Jesus speaks into this a question. In verse 3, Jesus answers them, "Have you not read?" Now, we can't grasp the full weight of this, but the Pharisees were supposed to be experts in the law. And this is the equivalent of like going to argue a case before the Supreme Court and saying to the justices, "Have you not read the Constitution?" It's a deep, cutting insult. It's speaking to the fact that they do not understand. They don't understand the Sabbath. They don't understand what God requires. They don't understand God's program. And Jesus speaks into that and he says, "Have you not read?" Of course, they've read the story. It's in 1 Samuel chapter 21. He says, "Have you not read what David did when he was hungry? He and those who were with him," and in verse 4, "how he entered the house of God, took and ate the bread of the presence, which is not lawful for any but the priest to eat, and also gave it to those who were with him." This is a crazy story. You can go read it this afternoon, 1 Samuel 21, 22. Let me just summarize it really quickly by saying, King Saul is in power. David has been anointed. He will be the king of Israel. And David is running for his life because Saul is trying to kill him. And David's gathered to him some men who are with him, and they're traveling and they're running for their lives. And Jonathan, Saul's son, is helping David escape from Saul on certain occasions. And there's this passing of intelligence, and King Saul is mad. He sees the writing on the wall, what's going to happen, and he's hunting David down, and he's looking to take David out, and anybody who befriends David becomes an enemy of King Saul, and King Saul starts wiping them out. So David is running for his life, and he's hungry, and he comes to this priest named Ahimelech. He comes to this priest named Ahimelech in this place called Nob, and this priest, David runs up to him, and he says, "I am starving. Do you have something to eat?" And the priest says, We don't have any common bread. The only bread we have is the bread of the presence. That's all we've got. Now, under God's law, no one could eat that bread but the priests. And David says to this guy, "I'm here on the king's business." He lies. "I'm out here doing King Saul's work." And the priest asks him a question, "Are you and your men, have you abstained from sexual relations?" Basically is what he asks him. And David says, "Yeah, we're good there. We're clean there." And so the priest gives him this bread, and David eats the bread, and his men eat the bread, and they go away. And in the next chapter, in 1 Samuel chapter 23, what happens in 22, what happens in that chapter is King Saul finds out what Ahimelech did. Somebody tells him, and he calls Ahimelech into the throne room, and he says, "Hey, did you help David out?" "No, I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't really do any of that." No, "We know you did. Somebody gave us intelligence that you did. Somebody ratted you out." And King Saul has that priest and all the other priests killed for helping David. I mean, it's a crazy story. And there's so much wrong going on in the story. You're not even sure, like, which wrong are we talking about here? Was it wrong for David to lie and say that he was with King Saul? Was it wrong for David to eat the bread of the presence? Which, the way Jesus asked the question, he doesn't even make an excuse for David. You've got King Saul, who's obviously wrong in killing the priest, and then the priest gave the bread of the presence to David, and is that wrong too? And it's like one of those stories where it's like, I don't even know where to begin with this story in terms of explaining like what's going on. And Jesus asked them the question about it. Now here's the problem when Jesus asked the question to these guys. They love King David. King David for them is their most revered and honored king. Everything is compared to King David. No one is as great as King David. No one has as great a power as King David. No one was as good as King David. And they're just hoping to get back to the place in Israel where they were when King David was on the throne. And you see it, don't you? They are standing in the grain fields with the King of Kings. And Jesus asked them a question about King David that is very messy. Very messy. And then he makes this great claim in verse 6, in verse 5. He says to them, "The Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath." The Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath. This is a radical statement. It's radical to their understanding of the Sabbath. It's radical to their understanding of who he is. And they're thinking about the greatness of King David. And so they don't want to answer the question. Because to answer Jesus' question is to say something negative about their most revered king. And Jesus just speaks right into it. He's not interested in addressing what's right or wrong in the story in Samuel. He just wants them to understand that a greater king is there. that they are standing in the presence of a greater king. And this king is the Lord of the Sabbath. He's the Lord of the Sabbath. He's the Lord of rest. Ultimately, at its core, Sabbath is about worship. And what Jesus is saying to them is that I am the Lord of the Sabbath. I am to be the object of your affection and your worship. That's who I am. I'm to be the object and the affection. I'm what your soul should be stirred for, the day of rest, this day of Sabbath. This is about me. And he starts to preach into that and speak into that. And it's not merely just a statement about the fact that Jesus can have his disciples eat the grain and that's okay, even though under their tradition they said it was wrong. It's not about who makes the rules on the Sabbath. It's not about rule keeping. It's about Jesus cherishing. And that's how we understand this day to have come to pass in the way that we observe it and honor it. That this, what we do here, it's not about all the rules we kept or the rules we made up and then we kept. It's about learning to cherish Jesus. And Jesus is right at the heart of that. I am the Lord of the Sabbath. We know in the church after the resurrection, after the death and resurrection of Christ, he rose on the first day of the week. And the church took this Old Testament practice of observing the Sabbath and they moved it to the first day of the week, the day of the resurrection of Christ. In Revelation chapter 1 and verse 10, it refers to this first day of the week as the Lord's Day. Now you might look at that and say, well, I thought all 7 days were the Lord's, so what's different about the seventh, about the first day of the week that it would be called the Lord's Day? It's unique in its understanding, and I believe it's a carryover from what the Old Testament observances were. Revelation calls it this Lord's Day. And they did it wisely, I think, and called it the Lord's Day and linked it to the resurrection of Christ. Because what the church is about Jesus. And if we're not about that, then we have nothing to offer. We have nothing to gain. We have nothing to show the world. What we are solely and simply is about Jesus. And that's it. Our rest and our remembrance is about Jesus, the Lord of the Sabbath. And so they call it this Lord's Day. Colossians chapter 1 and verse 18 says that Christ was made to be preeminent, meaning that he was made to be the first in all things. And so when we come here to gather, we're coming here for Jesus. And when we sing songs, it's not just because we're musically inclined. It's not just because music seems to uplift the soul. We sing about Jesus. And when we teach the word, we're not looking for rules. We're looking for the beauty and the glory of Jesus. And the day that as a church we stop being about Jesus, we should turn off the lights and shut the doors and go somewhere else. Because what we are is about Jesus, the Lord of the Sabbath. He is our rest, and it is him we are called to remember. Now, as I say, I think Luke was written to the skeptic, and maybe this morning you're skeptical about it. Like, how do you claim to be that? How do you claim? I mean, thousands of years the Jews have been keeping these rules and these traditions and doing the sacrifices and going to the temple and going and doing all of these things, and then you're just going to show up walking through a grain field and say, this is all about me? Like, if I'm a skeptic, I got a lot of problem with that. You mean for thousands of years this thing has been about you, leading up to you, and now you want to say it's all about you, that you are the Lord of the Sabbath? Like, how do I know that you're the Lord of the Sabbath? Because I've been trying to keep a lot of things. I've been trying to do a lot of things. I've grown up with this. How do I know that you're the Lord of the Sabbath? And I think this is why Luke puts this here. I think he's writing to the skeptic. And as we get later into the book of Luke and we get into the resurrection, I think Luke is specific about trying to write his gospel for the skeptic's question, and he does a great job of doing it. How do I know that Jesus really is the Lord of the Sabbath? How do I know he's supposed to be the object of my affection? How do I know that it's really about him? I thought you'd come to church to make yourself feel better. Maybe you're here this morning and you're coming to church because you think it's a good thing to bring your kids to, or because you think it might make you feel a little better. It's not about making yourself feel better, and it's not about just bringing your kids so they get to have some religion. It's about Jesus. And Jesus wants to affirm, and Luke affirms in his gospel, wants to affirm that he is the Lord of the Sabbath, and so he gives two proofs. On another Sabbath, he tells this story. Luke tells us the story, recounts the story. Jesus enters into the synagogue in verse 6, and he was teaching, and there was a man there whose right hand was withered. Dominant hand, the hand that you would use for all of your normal activities, and his hand is withered. And the text literally means that his hand was shriveled up. It's unuseful. It's not like his hand is broken. It's not got a cut on it. It's not as though you couldn't physically see that there was a significant problem with his hand. You could look at the man and know that there is no ability to use that hand. It is all shriveled up and it is completely useless. And he's there. And I think, listen to the story again, maybe the Pharisees and the scribes brought this guy to the synagogue for the very purpose of trying to use this to accuse Jesus. In verse 7, the scribes and the Pharisees, they watched him. They're watching Jesus. They're not listening to Jesus. Jesus is teaching in the synagogue and they're watching him. Here's what they're watching him about. They're watching him to see whether or not he would heal on the Sabbath so that they might find a reason to accuse him. Can your heart be more cold than that? They evidently know that Jesus is capable of healing. Why else watch him? I mean, my guess is, inside the room this morning, there's some people who have some physical limitations. And none of us are watching any of us trying to figure out whether one of us is going to walk over there and make whatever that physical ailment go away instantly. None of us are doing that, right? I mean, we didn't walk in here this morning looking at that, but even the cold, hard-hearted religious leaders are watching Jesus because they know he can heal the hand. And is he going to do it? They're looking for a reason to accuse him. Now in verse 8, the first supernatural proof that Jesus gives them, in verse 8 he says, "But he knew their thoughts. And he said to the man with the withered hand, 'Come and stand here.'" I'll show you in just a second how we know that Jesus knew their thoughts, but that's pretty spectacular. You ever had somebody say to you, "I know what you're thinking," and you're thinking, "That's not what I'm thinking"? Yeah, that never happened with Jesus. When Jesus knew their thoughts, he knew the sum total of their thoughts. He knew every thought they'd ever had. He knew everything about them. He was all-powerful, all-knowing. He knows their thoughts. First supernatural proof is that he knows their thoughts. And he says to the man with the withered hand, "Hey, come on right up here and stand right here. Come be with me. Come be right here. Come close to me." Now, if you're a Pharisee and a scribe and you know the Jewish tradition, you know that Jesus can sustain the life and he can prevent this man from dying, but it was a violation of their tradition if he did anything to help restore functionality or to help bring to a better life this person. All they could do under their law, under their traditions, was simply keep the man from dying. And so Jesus has him stand right here. And then in verse 9, Jesus said to them, "I ask you, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save a life or to destroy it?" This is a very difficult question for them to answer. That's why he asks it. Is it lawful to do good? Well, yeah, but only to a point. I mean, I can't do a lot of good. I can't actually physically help you get better. I can just keep you from dying. And so they would have said, "Well, yeah, it's lawful to do good. I obviously can't do wrong, but you can't do too much good on the Sabbath. You can't do too much acts of mercy on the Sabbath. You can't help too much. If you help too much, you've worked." They don't answer the question. And I love what Jesus does. And after looking around at them all, and I'm guessing that wasn't just like a quick pan of the room, right? The man with the withered hand is right beside him, and Jesus starts looking them in the eye slowly, person by person. And they're looking for a reason to accuse him. They're looking for something that he's going to do that gives them the right to say he's violating the Old Testament law or violating their traditions. And he looks around at all of them and then he says to the man, "Stretch out your hand." And the guy stretches out his hand and it's instantly restored. Now, wouldn't you love to see that? I mean, the hand is stretched out, and did it start restoring on the way up? Or did it like get all the way out there and it was still crippled, and then while it was hanging out straight ahead, all of a sudden it started getting restored and you could see the hand change? Or did it get there and then just instantly it was restored? And when it was restored, what did the man do with the hand? Did he put it back down? Did he start looking at it? Did he start, you know, grabbing stuff? I mean, what did he do with this hand? I think this is why the second thing Jesus does supernaturally is he actually heals the hand. It's a supernatural work. There's no question that only Jesus, only God could do that. He really must be the Lord of the Sabbath to accomplish a miracle like that. He knows their thoughts, and he healed the man. And I think he proves he knows their thoughts by simply saying to the man, "Stretch out your hand." It's interesting, in many of Jesus' miracles, he would touch them. Grab them by the hand, let them touch his garments. He took the mud and rubbed it on the man's eyes so that he could see. But Jesus doesn't do any touching. He just speaks it. The man lifts his hand. All the man has done is walked and lifted up his hand. He didn't even violate their stupid Jewish traditions, their crazy rules. He didn't violate any of them. I think Jesus was saying to them, "I want you to see that this observation about the Sabbath is about the power of a God who speaks things into existence." I think there is a connection here between the man's hand and the creation story, that God didn't create the heavens and the earth with his hands. He spoke them into existence. And Jesus does the same thing. He speaks healing and restoration. He makes the man, in essence, a new hand. He didn't need a scalpel to do it. He didn't need a surgery to do it. He just spoke it, and it was, and the man's hand was restored. These guys must have been blown away, but then unfortunately they weren't. Verse 11, it says that their response was that they were filled with fury and disgust with one another what they might do to Jesus. I think they were filled with fury not only because he healed the man and because he became more and more popular during this phase of his ministry, that common people started to follow him and learn what he was saying and be interested in the miracles, but I think they're furious that he healed the guy without violating their traditions. They were looking for a reason to accuse him, and the way that Luke writes it, you almost think that maybe they brought the guy with the withered hand to the place, they thought they had set him up, and then Jesus healed him with spoken word, and it's like they didn't have anything in their tradition about how to make stuff happen by speaking it, because they never thought that was going to be an issue, but now Jesus is on the scene, Lord of the Sabbath, and he can speak stuff into existence. He doesn't have to touch or heal. He can just speak it, and it is. I think there's some takeaways for us this morning quickly. Let me give you three of them. At the beginning of our service this morning, Seth read from Hebrews chapter 4 about the promise that we have of entering God's rest, and the writer of Hebrews says that that promise still stands, and it stands this morning. It's the promise of hope. It's the promise of a future. It's the promise of an eternal rest with God. It's a promise that no longer are we bound by the Old Testament law that we could not measure up to, but now God has sent one to fulfill the law on our behalf, to take our sin and to replace it with the righteousness of God. And I think there are three things that the Lord of the Sabbath would speak to us this morning, straight out of his word. The first thing that he would say to us this morning is, I think he would say, come to Jesus. Come to me. Come to Jesus. In Matthew 11, verse 28 and 29, Jesus said this, "Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls." Maybe you came here this morning to church because you thought it might make you feel better. I want you to know that who we are and what we are is solely because of Jesus. We aim to live differently than our world lives and differently than culture. But to the extent that we do that, it says nothing about us and it says everything about Jesus. Jesus has been for us rest. We have rested from our work, not in the sense that we no longer labor, not in the sense that we no longer do things for Him, but in the sense that God has worked for on our behalf before Him through Jesus Christ. And I'm not trying to earn God's favor. Jesus did all of that for me. And the promise of that is for you this morning. It is for you. The promise still stands that Jesus is saying, I want to be rest for you. I want you to come to me, you who are burdened by trying to live it up to the righteous standard of God. You cannot do it. And there is rest for the soul. Maybe this morning you know rest for your soul eternally. And maybe the busyness of life and the hardship of life and the difficulty of life needs to be spoken over you this morning, this simple truth that Jesus is rest. Come to me, all you who are burdened and heavy laden, and find rest for your souls. We find rest for our souls and we come to Jesus through His Word and through prayer. Can I encourage you this morning that if you are tired and you are weary, that Christless leisure is not the answer. Facebook will not help you with this. Internet surfing will not help you with this. TV watching is of no value in this. I'm not saying they're wrong. I'm just saying they're not rest. We have one rest in this life, and it is Jesus. And we have one rest in the life that is to come, and it is Jesus. And we have no other. And so if you are weary and you are tired, I say, come to Jesus. Press into Jesus. He is rest for your soul. Second thing is cast all your cares on Him. Cast all your cares on Him. 1 Peter 5:7 tells us to cast all our cares on Him, for He cares for you. Cast your anxious thoughts on Him. Cast your troubled ways on Him. Cast everything you're concerned about for this great promise, for He cares for you. He knows you intimately. He's not only saying, come and find rest in me, but He's saying all the stuff that you're carrying around that's bothering you and making you feel heavy laden and worn down and are burdens, I want you to take those and I want you to give them to me because I care for you. Give them to me. Whether you like to call it stress or worry, I say to you this morning that God wants that. Jesus wants that. He wants to take that off of you and for you to put it on Him. The way we find rest is to give up our anxious thoughts and all our troubled ways and give them to Jesus. Cast our cares on Him and hold fast to the promise that He cares for you. He knows your pain and He cares deeply about it. And He wants the pain and He wants to give you rest. Third thing, commit yourself to weekly corporate worship. Commit yourself to weekly corporate worship. God intended in our lives, I believe, there to be a rhythm to our remembering what God has done for us. And we have a lot of excuses sometimes about why we don't do church. And I just want to say it's good for the soul. God made the week so that every 7 days we would remember. And what we do here is about rest for the soul. It's about speaking into each other the truth of the gospel. And I was sitting over here singing God Undefeatable, one of my new favorite songs. And I could hear the people behind me singing God Undefeatable, Kingdom Unshakable. And they're speaking the truth over me. And we're singing it over one another. It is a good thing for us not to be alone in this life. And God designed the corporate gathering of His people to be an encouragement to one another. Not that we have it all together, but that we are really broken people, but we have found rest in Jesus Christ. And so we gather together to speak this simple, basic truth over one another, that Jesus is rest for the soul. I hope that resonates with your heart this morning. I hope it resonates with the heartbeat of our church. I hope this is the passion and the heartbeat of everything that we do, that Jesus is the Lord of the Sabbath. And He is our rest. Come to Jesus, cast your cares on Him, and commit yourself to worship. Let's pray. Father, we thank You this morning for the truth of Your Word. Thank you for allowing us to see in a new and a fresh way the glory and the majesty of Christ. Father, I thank you that you didn't just send your Son to claim that he was the Lord of the Sabbath, but you gave us proof. And our declaration this morning is that there is no one else like Jesus. No one else can know the thoughts of man. No one else can heal the withered hand. No one else can raise the paralyzed man. But God, most of all, our confession this morning is that no one can take a vile man like me. No one can take a sinful man like me and make him righteous. God, our declaration and our praise this morning is thank you for doing what we could not in a million years ever do. Thank you for taking our sin and giving us your righteousness. Thank you for being the Lord of the Sabbath. And would you help us remember what you have done for us, and may that be rest for our weary and tired souls. We pray this in the precious name of Christ, our Savior.